And that sound means it's time for another episode, All Movie Talk, episode 43 for July 24th in the year 2007. We're going to be talking about Terrence Malick this week, and if you're saying, who? Well, I don't blame you too much. The guy's a recluse, a little bit of a nutcase, but he makes some interesting films, so he's our director spotlight for this week. We'll have a trivia question, and then we'll move into our top six list, where we'll look at movies that play around with perspective. This is a really cool list I'm really happy with. And finally, we'll take a look at a great bad movie, the wonderful film from a crazy, insane, German director Uwe Boll. The film is Alone in the Dark, the perhaps worst video game adaptation of all time, and that really says something. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I am Sam Stoddard, and I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer
of Sam's been possessed
command.
By Malick.
Actually, I think I've just been shot.
Oh, the humanity.
Oh dear, I am bleeding."
In the 1970s, we had a whole lot of really interesting American directors who emerged. It was a time when studios were really big into embracing this idea of the director as auteur and allowing directors to have a lot of creative freedom. And it's where we start seeing people like Francis Ford Coppola pop up, or Martin Scorsese, or Robert Altman, or even somebody like George Lucas to an extent. And we kind of think of there being a sort of specific style to American 70s films and the directors of that time. And one of the more intriguing of them, though, is a guy whose work doesn't really kind of fit in. Well, I guess it does if you think about it, but he didn't really make movies that really feel like 1970s movies in a lot of ways. And that's the director whose work we're going to spotlight right now. It's a guy named Terrence Malick, who maybe you don't know his name. He's only made four films in the last 30-some years, so that's probably part of the reason. And even though those movies are celebrated, they are not real cultural institutions the way the other big films of the 1970s are, but I think they're really, really worth checking out. Malick has one of the most distinctive directorial styles, I think, of these American directors since the 1970s, and if you like one of his movies, chances are good you'll like all of them. On the other hand, it kind of goes that if you don't like one of them, chances are fair that maybe none of them will appeal to you. But Malick is an interesting guy. He has sort of a strange path to becoming a filmmaker. We'll just talk about that real briefly. He started off as a philosophy student at Harvard and later studied at Oxford. And I guess I've never read a real good source for this, but just from reading on the internet, I guess he dropped out of Oxford after he got into a philosophical disagreement with one of his professors. I don't know if that's the kind of thing that philosophy students do, like they have a disagreement over Kierkegaard and then quit going to school. I don't know if that's just a Malick thing or that's just philosophy guys in general. I don't know. So at that point, he kind of comes back to America, and he ends up working with the American Film Institute. He gets an MFA in film, and he directs a short film as part of the AFI's program. And then he makes his first feature in 1973, a movie called Badlands, starring Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek. And it's sort of a real big critical hit. He follows it up in 78 with another respected film called Days of Heaven. And then for 20 years, directs exactly no movies. And it's hard to figure out exactly what it was that Malick was doing during this 20 years. Part of this is because Malick is kind of a recluse. He pretty much will not do interviews. In fact, his contracts stipulate that the movie studios cannot release current photographs of him during the making of his movies. So it's even hard to figure out what the guy looks like. And so this 20-year period, from best I can figure, he was just kind of hanging around the world. He had a bunch of various movie projects and some scripts that he wrote or started, never got anywhere. He was in Paris for a while, and all of a sudden he kind of just comes back to this scene in 1998, well, obviously a little before then, because that's when the movie was released, to direct an adaptation of the novel The Thin Red Line. Directs an adaptation that pretty much disregards the parts of the novel he doesn't much care for and just goes off on its own. It's one of the strangest war films you'd ever see. It's about World War II and barely is about war. And then just last year, in 2006, released The New World. So, again, he's an interesting guy, and his movies kind of reflect this. They definitely, definitely reflect his background in philosophy. I know Sam has, in the past, criticized Malick's style because he has no problem with having his characters, and he often has narration all the time, loves narration. A lot of his characters just quote philosophers and poetry and just muse about the meaning of life or their situation they're in right now. And often the dialogue, especially the narration, seems very perpendicular to the action on the screen. We're just talking about things kind of at random, so there's stuff happening or just as frequently not happening. There's a very meditative quality to Malick's movies. He likes to just show us photography of nature. So we'll look at some trees while characters narrate kind of aimlessly. And there is sort of a rambling feel to his movies a little bit, and this kind of actually increases. His Badlands is actually, compared to his later movies, a fairly tight film with a pretty strong narrative structure. You watch a movie like A Thin Red Line, and it's just this sprawling 3-hour movie. You completely lose track of who the characters are or what's going on toward the end, and stuff just seems to be happening or not happening at random. But Malick is also interesting because all of his movies are absolutely obsessed with this idea of the clash between nature and civilization. And nature not meaning just the sort of non-human world, but also this idea that can there be the old idea of the noble savage. Is there a way that less advanced civilizations, to put it that way, can they live in harmony with nature? And how do they differ from Western civilization? I mean, is there a way that people who have come from Western civilization could return to nature? That's the question that really punctuates all of his films, absolutely. And he's also really obsessed with romance. All of his movies are, in some sort of sense, have really big romantic elements to them, and they're pretty much all tragedies as well. He seems to be drawn to this idea of romantic tragedies. And finally, really, really striking about his movies is just their gorgeous photography. Obviously, he's not the cinematographer on his movies, but he clearly, clearly has a lot of control in terms of how shots are set up, how they look, and all of his movies have a very, very similar look and feel to them. So let's move on to Badlands, then, this weird movie that sort of catapulted him to critical stardom, if you will. He's really well-respected among critics and scholars. More casual film watchers probably don't know who he is, but Badlands is a strange movie, as all of this will be, based on a true story about two serial killers who were these lovers, are kind of one of this minor crime spree in the 1950s, and Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek play the two lovers, and the movie really makes it out to be that it was sort of Martin Sheen who did it all, but it's strange in that it's really empathic with these two characters. I don't know that it excuses their actions exactly, but it certainly makes us sort of want to like them and to feel sorry for them. We get the real sense that the Martin Sheen character from the very beginning is a total nut job, but in kind of a likable way. One thing Malick does is that there are rarely clear villains in his movies. He sort of wants to humanize everybody and make us empathize with everybody, and I think he does it in Badlands, and it's ultimately kind of a road movie as these two lovers go out on this journey throughout. They get caught in what may or may not be a misunderstanding, and they try to return to nature and fail, and they can't fit in anywhere, and of course eventually it ends in tragedy. But man, I really like Badlands. I love the way the music, one thing I didn't mention is Malick's use of music. Really wonderful, interesting scores, really well done. And Badlands, I think more than any of his other films, I think Badlands is his strongest film, and I think, gosh, it creates such a strange feeling that it's unique, absolutely. No other movie feels like Badlands, and it has a very sort of American feel to it in a strange sense. It feels almost like a European, like maybe a French film, and not even necessarily a French New Wave film, just sort of a classically French movie done by an American about America. What do you think about Badlands, Sam?
I think that's a good way to describe it. It is more of a European movie. They're not quite as concerned with the plot beats, but establishing an atmosphere and characters. I like Badlands, actually. I think you probably like it more, but I was pleasantly surprised, actually, because I did not like The Thin Red Line, but we'll get to that. But one of the things that struck me, and you mentioned it before, how the narration is sort of orthogonal to the action. I was very intrigued by the narration, especially in the first part of Badlands. It was narrated by the woman. Her voice as narrator is so much more perceptive and eloquent and expressive than she is in the movie itself. She's an idiot and not very verbal at all. She does not express herself well within the movie, but as the narrator, she does. But more than that, the narration seems to be rewriting what's happening. She describes how he feels about her, which, well, first of all, how does she really know that? We don't see him expressing those feelings to her. So either they happened when we're not looking off screen, or more likely she's remembering a time and kind of rewriting or imprinting her own thoughts, her own interpretation on how he acts toward her. And that made the relationship interesting to me. I don't think it would have been as strong a film without that narration, especially early on, where we can sense that as this relationship is building and before any conflict has arisen, we're seeing something that's a little off. So that's an interesting element to me. On the other hand, toward the end, I was kind of conflicted about it. There was a part of me that was saying, why do I care to watch these two total idiots milling about in their idiocy? I mean, it was like, what? These characters aren't worth my time. I mean, I did care and empathize with them, but at the same time, I was questioning why I should. I had that little reservation, especially later on when they just start doing stupider and stupider things.
Yeah, I don't know if it's fair to call them idiots. I think it's clear from the very beginning that Martin Sheen's character is crazy. And some of it's very funny. I love the bit where she talks about how he never signs his name the same way twice, so nobody could forge his signature. I mean, that's... I think we should mention there's a lot of weird humor in Malick's scripts.
There are some great lines in it.
But I think the Spacek character, I don't think she's supposed to come off as an idiot so much as someone who's been kind of beaten down by the world. We get the real sense that her relationship with her father is not a happy one. I think the idea behind having the narration be so eloquent, in a sense, is that she's actually much smarter than she appears, but she's a follower. She has a real difficulty asserting herself, making herself heard, and...
Yeah, but just the fact that she's let her circumstances beat her down so much, it just... I mean, I feel bad for her, but at the same time, it's not really worthy of my respect.
Okay. And likewise, I don't know that, you know, certainly Malick isn't saying what they did was right. Malick is, you know, clearly something of a pacifist. I don't think he's going to argue that their violence is okay. But, yeah, I think we're supposed to feel sorry for her more than anything else. Well, Days of Heaven stars Richard Gere and Sam Shepard, and it's another kind of strange story, very simple at its core. It takes place, I think, in the 1910s. They flee the big city because Gere's got a murder charge on him, and they go off to find work at this farm, and she poses as his sister, his girlfriend poses as his sister, so that, you know, it looks okay if they're living together or whatever, and... the farm owner, played by Sam Shepard, takes a liking to her, and Gere encourages her to go sleep with him and become married to him because it will benefit them financially. But it's this weird love triangle because, well, I mean, Gere is essentially prostituting out his lover, who goes along with it at first because, you know, she loves Gere and wants to do what's okay for him, and then... well, she develops feelings for the Shepherd character, and then, of course, if I tell you that it all ends in great tragedy, you won't be surprised. This film feels in a lot of ways similar to Badlands, where you get the sense from the very beginning that everything's doomed and everything's going to go poorly. But it's also, oh man, against another film that's really gorgeous, wonderfully shot. It has more of that wonderful narration that you either like or you don't, and it's just a really interesting psychological tale of basically three people, and it could be a really small film. You could do this and imagine it as a really intimate movie, and Malick has this way of making these really small stories feel much, much larger. Badlands has a real epic feel to it, despite the fact that it's essentially just a little road movie with two people in it. It feels much larger than it is. Days of Heaven the same way, and I love the way that Days of Heaven captures this older time period. Maybe we should mention this at the beginning, is that all of Malick's films are period pieces in one form or another. Okay, well, let's talk about A Thin Red Line, because this is one that Sam and I differ on pretty strongly. It's a war movie about World War II, about the battle for Guadalcanal, but it only kind of, it's really, really, really weirdly paced, and I it's about 3 hours long. I understand Malick had to cut more than an hour out of the film, too, for the theatrical release. And I'll say straight up, the narrative is a mess, man, trying to figure out who these characters are. And it's got this huge cast of, at the time, you know, like, big-name actors, all of whom are in it for apparently 2 seconds before they kind of come and go. And then the characters all kind of look identical, they're all dirty. There's about 15 million narrators, and there's so many story threads that it's really hard to keep them all straight. And for a war movie, there's a lot of shots of trees in the sky. And start with these two Marines who have gone AWOL, and they've sort of gone natural, and they're living with this native tribe in some Pacific islands, and then they get picked up by their ship and sent back into duty, and then there's practically like an hour at the beginning of just them kind of hanging out and this really naturalistic setting, and then we get back into the military stuff, and there's this planning for this assault, and I don't know, I like the way this movie's kind of constantly undercutting itself. You know, when they land on the beach, everyone's all geared up for this big action, and there's nobody there. The Japanese have completely abandoned that position, and when we find the Japanese position later on, that becomes this huge, incredibly long, epic battle. And the battle is amazing. There's some just wonderful action sequences, even though Malick does kind of a good job of obscuring what's going on. I think deliberately he doesn't want us to be able to understand the exact flow and rhythm of the battle, and I think that actually makes sense more so than some... It's weird. It's not like these newer war action movies where you just can't tell what's happening because it's so frenetic. There's nothing frenetic about anything Malick has ever done. It's a very slowly paced battle, but still we get the very sense that battle and war is confusing, and there's some funny parts where people are being shot at, and they just can't figure out where they're being shot at or who's shooting and who they should be shooting at, and I don't know. My take on the Thin Red Line and the last hour of the movie is I don't like that much. It kind of goes up. My take on the Thin Red Line is, you know, Truffaut once said it was impossible to make a war film that was anti-war because war is just too exciting. I think Malick comes pretty close to it here. The action scenes are kind of exciting. I'll admit there is that sort of thrill to them. But he makes it so confusing and punctuates his actions with these long periods of stillness. And in the middle of a battle, soldiers lying in the grass thinking about the nature of life. And, you know, all of a sudden, it's that old cliche that war is hours of boredom with a couple seconds of sheer terror. Well, I think we capture that here. What do you think about Thin Red Line?
Oh, so pretentious. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you say you don't like the last hour, and, like, after the first 2 hours, I was like, I wasn't hating it, but after that last hour, I mean, oh, it's just too much to take. I mean, if I wanted to read poetry, I'd read poetry. If I wanted to admire a still image for 5 straight minutes, then I'd, you know, crack a photography book or something. It's like Malick tries to assemble all these different types of lyrical, beautiful, artistic moments. But unlike with Badlands, and presumably Days of Heaven, I haven't seen that one. I am looking forward to it, though. He doesn't seem to have a point. It doesn't seem to evoke a cohesive kind of feeling. You're right that he doesn't make the war exciting. I think that the problem with the movie at its core was the fact that it does lose the individual character experience. Like, you mentioned that, okay, after previously doing 2 movies about characters and having all this lyrical kind of packaging around a story with characters you can identify, now suddenly we're transplanted to this world where the characters are indistinguishable and don't really show up for that long, and we don't know what's going on with them, other than the fact that they're meditating about the image of a blood drop on a bit of grass or something. We lose that, so we get just the artistic kind of packaging, and there's nothing inside it. That was the frustration for me. I just don't believe that the characters in this who do the things they do and have the meditations and thoughts that they have really have much bearing on a larger picture. It's just not cohesive, and so it just felt like a director indulging himself and coming up with neat things. This felt like a David Lynch movie, to be honest. Lynch would be sitting around, oh yeah, wouldn't it be cool if a dwarf came in and talked about chewing gum? I'll put it in the movie. It felt like Malick was doing the same thing, except he has, you know, better taste.
Yeah, well, allegedly, much of the movie just sort of kind of happened, and he didn't stick to his script, and that's perhaps why part of it's a mess. He just kind of went out there and did what he felt worked. And Thin Red Line, I like. I like it. I think it's a good movie. It's a very interesting movie, I think. It's like nothing else, and for that reason alone, it's probably worth watching if you're interested in movies, because there's no other war movie like this. You may hate it. I can understand if you hate it. There's certainly stuff in there that is just not great, but I mean, come on. At the very least, hey, when you're seeing that still shot of a tree for 10 minutes, at least it's a nicely shot tree, right? It looks good. You gotta give him that much, at the very least. He never gives you ugly images.
Okay, all right.
Well, okay, if you thought that The Thin Red Line didn't actually have discernible characters, you may like his last film, or his latest film, rather, The New World, which is the story of Pocahontas, so that name of hers never actually used in the film, and the English colonist John Smith, and the first, you know, permanent English colony in America. Very, very interesting film. I've only seen the original cut of the movie. It was released in L.A. and New York for a couple of weeks, in late 2000. 2005 so that they could get Oscar nominations, and there was a 150-minute cut. So, you know, that's the version that I've seen. It was re-released later. Malick edited it down, apparently changed the pacing and moved around the scenes. That's the version that got released sort of wide into theaters and is on DVD. I haven't seen that one. I saw the original cut of it, which I thought was a wonderful movie. I've got a friend of mine who is obsessed with Malick. He saw New World 7 times in the movie theater, by the way, but he says that they're both great, so I should really get back and watch that, the shorter cut, some point in time. But The New World is a really, really interesting movie. I think, in a sense, it's the real most direct culmination of his other films. It's quite literally about this clash between, you know, Western colonists and these native peoples. But unlike most other treatments of this kind of story, it's far more nuanced. You know, this is maybe going a little off topic. There's this really weird thing about when you make movies about Western people colonizing native peoples is that for a long time you had the perception in Western literature that it was the people bringing civilization to the savages, and that was the way it went. And then at some point in time, we had this complete and total shift to the opposite, where it was the colonists who were these terrible, evil people, and it was the native peoples who were perfect and just had their lives ruined. And The New World doesn't fall into either one of those traps. It just presents everyone as being actual characters. It does a very, very good job of making everyone into a real person, and honestly does provide a pretty interesting discussion about the pros and cons of the sort of Western civilization versus the more naturalistic lifestyles the native peoples lived prior to it. So, again, it's got that same sort of lyrical sense to it. The version I saw is very, very slowly paced at parts. I could understand it. If you were just trying to get the plot, you could easily cut it down to less than 2 hours, but then it wouldn't be a Malick film. So any final thoughts about Malick, Sam?
I would not recommend even Badlands, which I did like, to somebody who is not prepared for a movie that is going to be the way it is. I mean, this isn't the kind of thing that you rent on a weekend night sometime after work so you can wind down. It's definitely a movie that you kind of have to work at and be patient with, and you can reap rewards out of it, but I just can't envision myself making that as a general recommendation. But, you know, for the right person, yeah, it is interesting, and it was interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, I have to, it's pretty much like this. If the idea of watching a former philosophy student make meditative, lyrical films that have a lot of narration about the meaning of life, that either sounds really great or really terrible to you, and I think you can tell straight up which one you are. And so if it sounds terrible, just feel free to ignore Malick. But if, on the other hand, you're intrigued and you're willing to put the time into it, seek out his movies. Watch them in order. Start with Badlands. It's probably his most accessible film, that and Days of Heaven. And if you do work at it, I think you can find a lot to love in his movies.
Time for our trivia question portion of the show. At the end of The Hunt for Red October, Jack Ryan, played by Alec Baldwin, brings home a teddy bear with him. Now, that teddy bear was already a veteran motion picture actor by that point, because he had previously starred in another big-budget action movie. Well, this week's trivia question is, what was this teddy bear's earlier film role? That sounds like an exciting question, huh?
Sam, are you seriously asking me trivia questions about teddy bears now? Is this what we've come to?
Yeah, and for a very specific reason, but you'll find out at the end of the show. One of the great things movies can do for us is show us different points of view or perspectives. Sometimes a movie will just give us one and we kind of absorb that, and it might not be our perspective on the topic. And then other movies give us a bunch of different perspectives and let us kind of see the differences and try to get down to the truth of things based on juggling these different points of view together. There's all kinds of different ways a movie can play with perspective, and it's quite interesting. So we're going to have our top six list be about movies that play with perspective. And I'll start right off with my number six choice, which is a Woody Allen movie called Melinda and Melinda from 2004, one of his later movies, and he wrote and directed it. It doesn't star in it. But as it opens, these guys are sitting around a table at a restaurant and talking about comedies versus dramas, and there's these two great writers present, and they're kind of arguing about whether real life is comic or if it's tragic, just inherently. And so one of them tells a story as an example to back up his perspective, and that is essentially a comedy. It's a story that is a comedy. And then the other guy turns around and says, well, hang on a minute, look at it this way, and he retells the same story as a drama or a tragedy. And so we cut back and forth the rest of the time between these two different versions of the same story that kind of unfold in parallel. Essentially, what we're getting is the same story told once as a comedy and again as a tragedy. And it's great at illustrating how the difference is sometimes just a matter of perspective. Even more so, though, by contrasting these two things, the mechanics of storytelling in these genres are sort of exposed to us, and we can see, okay, this version played the story this way, and that version played it that way. And that helps us come to kind of a better understanding about how storytelling itself works, and maybe how we skew real life to fit into these prepackaged forms of entertainment. Very interesting movie.
Yeah, well, for my number six movie, I went maybe a little more literal in terms of perspective and picked Dark Passage from 1947 by director Delmer Daves. This is kind of a famous movie because it's one of the very few movies that features a really extended first-person shot. So the movie stars Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. It's one of their pairings, though probably the lesser of their pairings on film. But it's still an interesting movie, and it's basically Bogart plays this guy who's been sent to jail for committing murder, and he escapes. And for the whole first half of the movie, pretty much, we see things from his perspective. The entire thing is a first-person shot from him. We don't see his face at all. We hear his voice, we see his hands, hear him talking to himself, that kind of thing. And then at one point, to disguise himself, he undergoes plastic surgery, and when he comes out, he's Humphrey Bogart. So, you know, kind of a strange deal. You plastic surgery, come out looking like Bogart. I don't know if that's such a good thing, but there you are. The second half's not really quite as interesting as the first, to be honest, but it's still kind of cool. It's one of the very few movies that does this. There aren't really a lot of movies that really get into a character that literally for that long of a period of time. It's a very sort of expressionistic, in a sense. We're literally seeing things through this guy's eyes, and it's a cool use of that first-person perspective, which maybe is now more common if you play a lot of video games. You see it a lot, but still pretty rare to see it in this kind of extended sequence in the movies.
Yeah, and we mentioned another movie on the show, Lady in the Lake by Robert Montgomery, adaptation of the Chandler novel that plays this kind of thing throughout the whole running time. It doesn't quite work. Dark Passage is, I think, a really good movie. I mean, it's not The Big Sleep, it's not To Have and Have Not, but I really like it, and I like that kind of gimmick to it, and of course the chemistry between Bogart and Bacall is just something you can't duplicate anywhere else. My number five is a movie called Blow Up from 1966. And, well, most of the movies will be talking about, say, things about perspective by showing us multiple points of view. But here's a movie that does the same sort of thing by showing us only one perspective and showing how much information is missing, how much is he is not able to witness himself and therefore is not in the movie and we don't know it either. In a nutshell, this photographer is snapping some photographs in a park one day and he thinks he has accidentally photographed a corpse. So he sets about trying to figure out what he's photographed and solve this mystery. But the movie never really gives us a full explanation of what's going on because he never really gets that. You can theorize about what might have happened, but in the end you just don't know. And this is a little jarring because movies tend to tell us complete stories. By the end you know all the answers. But life isn't like that, so, you know, sometimes you run across things that you can just never explain, and this movie illustrates that point by showing us how limited a single perspective can be. It's especially important, I think, that this guy is a photographer, because we think of photographs as being objective snapshots of reality, and it's true that, you know, they're not as skewed over time by the imperfect way the human memory works, but in the end, even a photograph is still only giving us a limited single view of reality. It shows us one piece of the puzzle, and that's incomplete, so, you know, sometimes it can still imply things that just aren't true.
That's a fascinating pick. I wish I dig what you did there. Getting, you know, really playing with it, that's a good pick. Great movie, one of my favorites. I'm sure to say I stayed a little bit more literal with my choices. Not as literal as Dark Passage, but I think mine are going to be a little more obvious. I didn't quite go down that same depth that Sam did. So my number five movie is one of the sort of recent classics that explores the idea of having an unreliable narrator. A lot of films use a flashback structure or a structure where there is somebody narrating the movie to us, doing voiceover work, but we always sort of assume that that person's telling us the truth. But my number five pick is The Usual Suspects from 1995 by director Bryan Singer, which questions this idea. What do we get when we have a movie that's largely a flashback being narrated by someone when that someone has incentive to lie to the person to whom he's telling the story, which in effect is us? So we see these events unfold and we're basically reconstructing this crime scene as one of the criminals involved tells us what, well, he's telling the cops what happened and how he came to be there and how all his associates came to be killed. And we sort of go through all these things, and you know, probably most people are aware there's sort of a twist at the end, and I'm hinting at that now too, that everything that you're being told isn't necessarily the case. And it's a great example of sort of having a rug pulled out from under us right at the very end of the film, and we really have to reevaluate what we've seen before it. There are a couple of movies that do things like this, but I think this is one of the better ones. Maybe a little bit unsatisfying because we do so literally get the rug pulled out from under us. I'm not sure if there's any real way to anticipate it until you've seen it once, but it's still a lot of fun and a cool flick.
Yes, it is. And as you were talking, I was reminded of a couple others that employ a similar thing. You know, Memento, we've talked about before, has a little question there. There's a B-movie from the 40s called Detour, the film noir that critics just are sort of rediscovering and absolutely love, and I don't think it's actually that good, but there is one interesting element in the fact that we question the reliability of the narrator and what we're actually seeing. For number four for me, I got a movie from 1998 called Run, Lola, Run. Here's the idea. There's this woman who needs to rescue her boyfriend from people who he is in debt to and are not going to employ necessarily the legal means to even that score. But she runs across these bit characters as she is trying to rescue him. And this is what I want to focus on for this because, you know, maybe she bumps into somebody. She's trying to get somewhere. And normally, you know, in real life and in the movies, these people, you just kind of, you know, the fruit cart. Whoever owns the fruit cart that's always getting knocked over as car chases go by, you never really know anything about those characters except that they own a fruit cart that got knocked over. And in Run, Lola, Run, there's some people she kind of brushes across. And again, normally you don't know anything about them except that they happen to be there at that time. But this movie does kind of a neat thing, almost gratuitous you could say, but it's just kind of having fun with style here. It gives us these quick flashes all of a sudden. We run across a character, then flash, 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 flash. We get five, six still shots that tell the story of the rest of their life that goes on from there. And so, yeah, okay, this is a person that doesn't mean anything to Lola herself. She's just, you know, runs by him. But now, suddenly, for like 2 seconds, we're going to tell a story about that character. So we're kind of broadening our perspective of the people that we don't know anything about in our lives. That's really kind of cool.
Yeah, that's always been my favorite part of that movie. That's a pretty neat fleck, too. But, yeah, I love those flashes, and I love the way that they differ on depending on how she runs into them. It's sort of a weird butterfly effect kind of idea. Really, really cool bit. My number four pick is a movie called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie from 1972 by the great surrealist director Louis Buñuel. It's a really strange movie that can't adequately be described. You really have to see it. It's basically about a bunch of people who keep trying to have dinner, and for one reason or another, they keep getting interrupted. But why I picked it for this list is because as the film goes on, the reasons that they keep getting interrupted become stranger and stranger to the point where we really start playing around with perspectives. I mean, this is a movie that has, like, a flashback sequence inside of a dream sequence inside of a dream sequence. It'll be the sort of thing where they go to eat dinner and then they realize that they're all in a play and the food's all fake, and then some character wakes up and he goes to his kitchen to have something to eat, and then another character wakes up and he was dreaming about him. And, you know, by the end of the movie, we have absolutely no clue exactly whose perspective we're ever seeing at a given time. I mean, it really plays with the idea that normally in movies we believe that we're having sort of an objective look at things, and here's a movie that really throws that away, that says no, there is no real objective look at things. There are a couple of interesting surrealist flicks I could have picked for something like this. Another interesting movie that I'm not a big fan of, I'll just mention it if you want a movie that really plays around with perspective and questioning what's real and what's not, is a film called Last Year at Marion Bad. Really interesting, strange, and in my mind, a little too strange for me to really appreciate it. But if you want to see a movie that really, really plays around with perspective, you could check that out as well.
Great pick. Okay, I'm glad we're dipping into some of the more unusual areas of film here. Number three for me is, a usual area for me, because we featured it in episode 34. It's the movie Shortcuts from 1993 by director Robert Altman. And so I'll be brief here, because you can go back to that episode here and talk all about it. But basically, you get these many different perspectives of a large cast of characters. And we sort of see more or less the whole story of how these couple dozen characters interact, whereas each of the individual characters only see their own pieces of it. And so we have a privileged view. We have this tremendously greater understanding of what's going on than they do. And it makes me wonder how much of this kind of thing happens in our own lives. I mean, what are we missing out on because we are limited to our own individual, localized views of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Another interesting choice. And I guess, and I'm feeling a little bad because now I feel like my list was a little too restrictive when I thought we were talking about perspective.
Oh, this is good to get contrast.
So I was being a little more literal here, which is why for my number three pick, I picked a movie we've talked about before that Sam already mentioned, that Rascal. And that's Memento from 2000 by Christopher Nolan. Way back in our very first episode, we talked all about Chris Nolan and this film, so you can go back and listen to that if you want to. But if you don't know the overall structure of the movie, it's a movie that's told backwards, except for the parts that are told forwards. It's kind of hard to explain, but it makes sense. And the fact that it's got such a complex and cool, convoluted structure, I think makes it a really great pick for this list, almost obligatory. I mean, the way that it makes us really question what we're seeing by the time that it's in, when we have all the pieces of information, go back and watch it a couple times, and, you know, like Sam said, it has a little bit of an unreliable narrator kind of thing going to it. But there's more to it as well, because we learn things the narrator himself doesn't know, or that he did know until he gets them. It's a very neat movie, and one that works pretty well and ages well in your head. A really great movie.
Yeah, I mean, how many narrators do you have that don't know what's going on? He's the least informed of anybody. Anybody else could have narrated this movie better and more completely. Really neat the way that works. Number two for me is one that plays with perspective in order to achieve humor. Now, this is a French movie from 1967 called Playtime, and it's actually part of a series, kind of loosely connected series, the third that a French comedian named Jacques Tati made in the 50s and 60s about his character Monsieur Hulot. And I definitely want to talk about him later in the podcast at some point, but specifically talking about perspective, it's fascinating to me how much this movie relies on the exact view of the camera. We're talking about camera perspective now, to achieve these visual gags. In the world of the movie, this is a futuristic kind of Paris. It's grown up into this sterile kind of world of polished metal and plate glass, and every building is the same as every other building. And what's great is how there are these little pockets of the old world kind of nestled between all the skyscrapers. You'll get some woman on a corner selling plants, and so you get a little bit of green and nature amidst the overpowering technological edifices and everything. Well, somewhere in this vision of Paris is the Eiffel Tower. But we only ever see it in the reflection of a glass door when it's open just right, or things like that. I mean, the joke is that there are these little bits of color and culture still hanging around, but we're never quite able to actually see them. So, you know, that's one way of talking about perspective in terms of this movie. But there's another sequence where Monsieur Hulot is trying to find his way through this maze of cubicles on an office floor. And literally the only landmark that around him that he can use to kind of gauge where he is and navigate by is the fact that there's this secretary in the middle of this junction of aisles between the cubicles, and she's inside this circular desk. And so, you know, he peeks down the aisle and sees her facing him. So, okay, if he goes this way, turns a corner, then he should be able to look down this way and see her from the side. Okay, well, that's what he tries to do to navigate this maze of cubicles. But while he's doing that, she swivels around in her swivel chair, and so when he looks at her again, she's still facing him, and he's all confused. I mean, the joke only works because the cinematography makes it clear what's happening and kind of shows us his perspective of these identical views of the office floor from different physical locations. I mean, there's another way to use perspective for humor. But there's a ton. I mean, it's wall-to-wall, these visual kind of gags, like how a waiter is pouring water in a glass at a table, but the way the shot is constructed, there's this woman with a flowered hat in the foreground, so it looks like the waiter's watering the flowers on her head. I mean, hilariously inventive stuff, and I think a real masterpiece of filmmaking there.
Yeah, and once again, Sam going for the less obvious choices than I was. But my number two pick here is sort of the granddaddy of all of the movies that are on my list, these movies that literally play around with perspective and play around with the way we are perceiving what we're seeing. And it's a German silent film from 1919 or 1920, depending on how you want to count it, called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. This is one of the very, very first German expressionist films. We've talked about that whole movement in the past on the show. But here is a movie that quite literally plays with perspective in every shot, because things are constantly looking really strange to sort of illustrate the moods or emotions or just for the general state of the characters. That's the whole idea behind expressionism, is that the world itself, the very physical composition and look of every shot, is bent to the emotional whims of these characters. And on top of that, there's this weird frame story that only kind of makes sense at the end, and then maybe really calls us into question exactly what we saw. I mentioned Usual Suspects from 1995 pulling the rug out from under us, something that seems pretty popular in Hollywood movies these days. Well, back in, you know, 1919, in the silent era, here's a movie that pioneered the whole idea of really pulling the rug out from underneath the audience. I don't know that anything had ever done that before in movies prior to this film. Most of the movies from the silent era are pretty straightforward. They don't have too complex of a plot, and where they do have plot complexities, it's more just for gags. I mean, here's a movie that's taking it seriously to have sort of a horror kind of, not quite horror, well, maybe horror in the more traditional gothic sense, the psychological horror and darkness, but here's a movie that really does it, and really, when it pulls the rug out from under us, it's just really neat and a trippy, strange, really fun movie.
That's a great pick. I think you're a little too hard on yourself. And in fact, I would think any German expressionist film would be a great pick for this list, and I'm kind of surprised I didn't wind up with any myself. For number one for me, though, I think I did take a bit more of a traditional view, and I think it'll be your number one, or you're going to be kicking yourself. My number one is Rashomon, from 1950 by Akira Kurosawa, and, well, it's all about the reliability of eyewitness accounts. Basically, there's some incident that happens off in the woods somewhere. There's a couple of people present, and a crime seems to have been committed, and so what happened? We got to figure out what happened so we know what to do about it. And so we get a witness, and that witness tells the story, and then we get another witness, and that witness tells the story, and they're a little different. They're, in fact, sometimes dramatically different. But then we see another account and another account, and they're all coming from, actually, you know, despite the limited number of views we could possibly have of the account, because we know who was there, it's actually surprising the witnesses that this movie comes up with to tell us the story again. But every version is quite a bit different and really exposes this idea that just because somebody saw what happened doesn't mean they really know what happened. You all have your own kind of subjective interpretation of what you see. So a great, great movie, and definitely drives that point home.
Yeah, and it was my number one pick as well. You know, in a movie like The Usual Suspects, or to some extent Memento, we have unreliable narrators in part because they're deliberately lying or being lied to. What I like about Rashomon is the idea that people can have mutually exclusive accounts of events, and none of them are lying. All of them, I believe their event to be true, I think. I don't know that anyone's deliberately lying in Rashomon. Sort of subjective, it's up to you to make the call, but I just really, really like that, because I think too often in life we tend to believe, well, you know, what I saw is the objective truth, and anyone who disagrees with me is lying. They know it's true, and they're just lying for their own personal reasons. I alone, you know, possess the truth. Rashomon says no. It's very easy for us to filter events through our own views, and especially as we recall them. You know, there's this whole idea that in reality, when you access memories, it's not really quite like reading information off a CD-ROM from a computer. You don't just call up bits off a disk, really, as you access memories, you kind of change them depending on your own mood. And so remembering things, that's why stories change over time. As you tell them each time, you actually change your memories as you access them. And here's a movie like Rashomon really driving that point home and using cinematic devices like the flashback just wonderfully well. I mean, here's another movie that really sort of sets up this whole idea, very groundbreaking in 1950 in a lot of ways, and a movie that holds up extremely well today. This is still a very clever, very engrossing drama told in a really, really interesting way.
Great. Okay, well, let's recap. My number six choice for movies that play with perspective is Melinda and Melinda from 2004. Number five, Blow Up from 1966. And number four, Run Lola Run from 1998. Number three, Shortcuts from 1993. Number two, Playtime from 1967. And number one, Rashomon from 1950.
And my top six list, number six, Dark Passage from director Delmer Daves in 1947. Number five, Bryan Singer's The Usual Suspects, 1995. Number four, Louise Buñuel's 1972 film The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. Number three, Memento by Christopher Nolan from the year 2000. Number two, the great German expressionist film The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920. And number one, Akira Kurosawa's great film Rashomon from 1950.
Stephen, you know, fear is the thing that protects you from the things you don't believe in.
Mm.
Words of wisdom to live by.
Absolutely.
So, for example, I'm afraid of spiders. I'm afraid of heights. And as it turns out, coincidentally, I do not believe in spiders or heights. So I guess this quote is right on. What are you afraid of? Anything?
I'm afraid of famed German director Uwe Boll. He terrifies me.
And that's another thing that we don't really believe in, right?
I don't believe he exists.
But as it happens, a lot of people do, including himself, and he's made a number of movies, all based on video games, because I guess, what's the deal? I think German tax law says that, this is paraphrasing, but I think Article 7, Paragraph B says something like, if your movie that you're shooting is about a video game, then you're tax exempt.
Yeah, not. I think that's maybe not quite the gist of it, but close enough.
Isn't it?
He's actually directed a few movies that are not video games, but that was early in his career before he realized that the best way to make a dollar was to take a franchise people had heard of and just make a terrible movie out of it.
But there is some tax law like that, right?
Yeah, it's actually not related to video games, though.
Oh, that's too bad. I was really hoping the Germans had this law about video games and tax.
No.
Well, anyway.
He takes an advantage of this law where it's kind of complicated, but essentially I think it's to encourage German productions of films, and so he gets all these German investors who invest in the movie, and then they write it off, so they can invest in these movies and make money, even if the movies don't make money, kind of a deal.
So the bottom line for us is we cannot stop the guy.
No, it's
and
impossible.
That's unfortunately the message that we've got for you today. We're going to talk about one of Uwe Boll's movies, and yeah, so German director makes pretty terrible movies, but you know, we really shouldn't say that, because let me tell you about this guy. I have not known any director more affected by the things people write on the IMDb message boards. a year or so ago now, a guy issued a challenge that, all right, I've had it with you people writing nasty things on the IMDb. I'm just sick of you all. All right, I'm going to set up a challenge. If you've written a negative review of one of my movies between these dates, I will challenge you to a boxing match. And he assured everybody that it would be just basically an exhibition match, and it was just a publicity stunt and all that. And a number of people took him up on the offer. One of them was the guy Lotax from somethingawful.com, and he went and fought him. And apparently he just beat them all to a pulp.
Yeah, I guess Uwe Boll is a former boxer.
He did turn back the one guy who had boxing experience. Yeah, he's a former boxer, and he didn't want to be fighting any other former boxers or something. He just wanted to beat up people who said bad things about his movie.
The best part about that challenge is when he issued it, there's a list of people who were automatically invited because of their hatred and vitriol toward him, and they were all just like these terrible IMDb usernames. He's like, listen, if you're one of the following critics, and this guy's like, Sergeant guy, 79, is kind of nonsense. Like, yeah, okay, wow. I can see how these professional film critics
are really
messing with your head.
No, I don't like the tone you're taking with Sergeant Guy. I mean, it's him and Ebert for me. That's what. Anyway, so yeah, there's this movie, Alone in the Dark, based on Alone in the Dark, and it stars
Christian Slater.
Christian Slater
and Tara Reid
as the guy who believes in the things that you don't believe in, that protects you from the fear of the. Anyway, he's just kind of hanging out, and I'm not sure what his regular job is.
I think it's just
to outrun guys.
They say that he's a paranormal investigator. There's a lot of those. It pays well.
Paranormal investigator. That's his cover. So there's these artifacts all over the world that people can get a hold of and do scary things with, so he's got to stop them and have big, long fights in the streets, because there's no better way to keep a low cover than to do that. Yeah, so some other quotes from early on in the movie: just because you can't see something doesn't mean it can't kill you. Another great bit of words of wisdom here. There's a great scene early on where, all right, this guy's trying to dig up a sunken ship, because on it is some kind of a box with power inside it. Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so he's got this operation to go lift this thing out of the ocean, and there's another guy with him who's kind of dubious about this plan, doesn't really like that idea, so he imparts these words of wisdom to this fellow. He says, a sunken ship is like a grave. It should never be disturbed.
Yes.
Okay. Well, anyway, I can't even begin to talk about this. I can quote a couple things, but when I keep trying to talk about the plot, and I just can't do it.
Well, you know, the thing is, here's the way the movie starts. I think it's like, no joke, 5 minutes of scrolling text trying to explain the backstory, and it's read to us. By the way. Some reviewer I remember reading quipped that it's read to the audience because the intended audience for this movie probably can't read it themselves, but it's just, there's no joke, it just goes on and on with all this backstory, and it doesn't help at all. It's talking about, like, there's this ancient civilization, and there's this government paranormal agency, and 10,000 years ago there was this gate that opened to where again? And there's two worlds, and it's all very confusing. And then there's like a flashback immediately after that that sets up the opening, and then we flash forward to the present, and there's like these different groups of people, like you said, the guy doing the stuff with the boat, and this Ark of the Covenant, or whatever it is that they find, and at no point in time was it ever clear what was going on.
Yeah, but the great thing, though, is it doesn't matter, because you never really feel like you're any more lost than you should be. You know, sometimes a movie loses you, and you think, oh, I'm not appreciating this right. And there's a great bit on the commentary. If you watch Alone in the Dark, and I think we're recommending that you do as a good, bad movie, that's our segment right now, but listen to the commentary as well, because Bull gives just a wonderful commentary. And about the opening crawl, he said the opening crawl was added later because nobody understood the movie. And you still don't understand the movie. I mean, like, you're right, it doesn't help at all.
I think this crawl makes things worse, honestly.
So anyway, the first basic scene is Christian Slater tracked down by this guy who's, you know, maybe he's superhuman, genetically altered, and he can't be harmed by bullets. I mean, bullets don't even slow the guy down. But he's just, you know, they have this big fight, and they shatter glass, and they end up in an ice factory or something, because whenever you have a fist fight, basically there's usually a factory on hand for you to have it in. And the guy gets stabbed, but I don't know why those bullets didn't work.
It's very confusing what hurts that guy.
Thing, you know. Actually, I wonder if he was firing blanks. I bet that was it. Because I think they use blanks on movie sets a lot.
And according to the Wikipedia entry, that the Christian Slater character has supernatural powers. I don't remember that from the movie. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, he could jump through broken glass while engaged in a fist fight, land on the street below without being hurt. I think that was his superpower.
That opening fight scene, I guess not the opening of the movie, the first real scene where you can figure out what the heck is going on, where just Christian Slater fighting this dude, reminds me a lot of the fascinatingly endless fight scene from They Live, the great 80s movie, well, not so great, where these two guys just fight for no real reason for about 20 minutes. Likewise here, I have no idea why Christian Slater was fighting this other evil demon guy. Was that ever explained, by the way, why they were fighting?
Well, that's part of the mystery. but actually what it was is Christian Slater got a hold of this archaeological thing. Indiana Jones. And the guy wanted it back, because if you get all the pieces together, then there's some kind of thing that happens, and if the good guys get all the pieces together, then they can stop the thing from happening. You know, it's just standard archaeology. I mean, this is basic stuff.
Who is the supernatural guy they're fighting? There are bad guys, but it's not clear to me who or what they are exactly. I mean,
I would tell you that, but I don't recognize that actor. And that's the thing going on in the sunken ship, because I want to get back to that. I mean, he says, okay, it's like a grave, should never be disturbed. But the retort is the real thing that makes that line. He says something about, I don't have to respect your ill-informed superstitions. Now think about what an ill-informed superstition is all about, and you got the idea. So the dialogue is great dialogue, like, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it can't kill you. I mean, there's things that sound, I don't want to say they sound great, but they sound kind of cool, you know, it's trying to go for that cool vibe, something really catchy, something you can put on a poster for the movie and have that be your tagline. And if you think about it for an instant, it all falls apart, and it's just hilarious. So that's the really great thing about these movies, is just the writing. When they bring the thing up from the ocean, of course, there's a big ark-looking like box, and it's all gold, because this civilization that made this thing was actually the first people, this is true, the first people in history to store their valuables inside solid gold chests. I mean, that's how you protect your jewelry. And so they open it up against the better judgment of some of the other people there. I mean, the guy said, no, don't open it here. There's going to be an evil that comes out. And they say, well, it's a solid gold chest. What's inside? So they lock the guy in a compartment on ship, and then they open it. And you know, the guy's fighting to get out. He just can't get out because they've locked him in. And so he hears all the carnage happening outside. Some monster has killed them all. And when it's all over, he lets himself out to check out the damage. I love that. Door stays locked only as long as he needs to be there. What was your favorite part of Alone in the Dark?
Oh, well, I love the opening text, because you think it's over, and then it just keeps going and going and going. My other favorite, well, I love the commentary. I love Tara Reid as an archaeologist. That is just some awful casting, and if you listen to the commentary, man, there's this crazy scene where it's like clearly gratuitous sex scene between Reed and Slater early on in the movie, but there's no nudity or anything. In fact, you don't see anything at all, and when you listen to the commentary, well, one, you get to hear Bull lamenting the fact that Reed would not get naked for the movie like she was scripted to do, and then he vows to never again work with American actresses because they're too prudish for his tastes. And then he goes off to say that, oh, it's a big disappointment to the fans that they don't get to see Tara Reid topless. But then he immediately claims that the scene is not at all gratuitous because, hey, these people haven't seen each other for a long time, so of course they would have. But, and yet, in the movie, they're broken up. They are like former lovers, and yet immediately, as soon as Chris Slater stops that fighting with that supernatural guy, they just jump into bed. And then a little bit later on, you get this great comment from Bull about Tara Reid. Throughout the movie, she's carrying around a clipboard, wearing a lab coat, and wearing glasses. And at one point, he comments, you know, those glasses really make Tara Reid look intelligent. Just a slight pause, and then he adds, I hope, which is perfect, because, you know, here's the guy who directed the movie, not at all convinced that his supposedly super genius archaeologist, Tara Reid, looks super intelligent archaeologist, despite her stylish glasses. I mean, that's the entire movie, summed up right there. Uwe Boll believes that if he puts Tara Reid in glasses, that's pretty much all the work he needs to do to pass her off as an archaeologist. Oh, I love that line. That's funny.
A great line. I'm going to chime in with my own favorite part of the commentary here, and that is, there was this one section where he was diverging from talking about the movie itself and talking about the climate, the business climate, you know, the industry that he made it in. And he was complaining, and it took me a while to figure out where he was going with this and like why he was saying this, but he was complaining, and this actually is really true, you know, that there's always lots of money and advertising resources available for the big budget blockbusters, but not a lot of money to advertise independent films, except a few. There's a few at the end of the year. You get an Oscar season. and then independent films really get a lot of money. There's a few independent movies that the people think can win Oscars, and so they put a lot of backing behind them, and they get into theaters, and they do get airtime on television and everything. But that's it. For the most part, independent films really don't get a lot of commercial attention. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, that's all a very interesting perspective. Why are you talking about it? It didn't dawn on me that he thinks that this is his Shakespeare in Love, and this is his independent movie, and he was lamenting the fact that he didn't get the money to advertise this and put it in the Oscar race or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow, what an amazingly twisted sense of, I mean, you cannot look at Alone in the Dark. Okay, maybe it didn't get as much money to make it as some of these others, and, you know, its budget was more of an independent type of budget, but that doesn't mean it's an art house film. Oh my goodness.
Well, no, did you hear this? I love the part where toward the end he starts trying to explain the theme of the movie, because after there's all this archaeological stuff, eventually it's revealed that there's this gateway between worlds, and there's this other shadow world that's like parallel to ours, and there are these giant evil alien bugs that don't look at all like the creatures from Alien or anything, and they're like coming into our world, but they're harmed by light, but it's not really getting entirely clear. Then Uwe Boll trying to explain all this, apparently it's a big allegory for environmentalism.
It is.
He's saying that because the humans have destroyed our planet, we've destroyed all the nature and natural habitats, and I think he puts something like, you know, the dark secret places in the world that now the creatures have to come and attack us. But it makes absolutely no sense, because the movie clearly makes the case that the creatures live not in our world, but in another world, and that they're invading our world. So why it has anything to do with the humans destroying our planet makes no sense, because the rules of the movie would imply that the humans destroying Earth wouldn't affect the alien bug world at all. I'm not at all clear where he's going with that.
Maybe the idea is that the bugs destroyed their world, and so they have to come to ours, because we're doing everything right. Actually, wait, that wouldn't send the message either, would it?
Exactly, yes. Very, very, very confused metaphor there. I'm not.
Yeah.
But yeah, he clearly thinks that he's made a very intelligent, sophisticated action-adventure film. I mean, he's not. You could understand, like, if he's just a mercenary guy, like, you know, a Roger Corman type, right? Just cranking out movies to make some bucks. But he really and truly believes this is a good movie. That's what's so confusing about it.
I mean, it's not even Ed Wood. And the great thing about Ed Wood is he really thought he was, like Uwe Boll, he really thought he was doing great work. I mean, this was his Citizen Kane, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space or whatever, Ed Wood. But the difference there is he's kind of this meek guy, just a humble guy doing his thing. And, you know, Uwe Boll's a guy that's just, I am not only making my Citizen Kane, but I'm going to beat you up if you talk trash on me. On the internet, and he even says that in the commentaries, like, this movie is better than that trash they write on the internet. Well, let's talk about the ending.
Oh, boy.
Because that ties in, because there's a particular ending that he wanted, and it was kind of a last-minute ad, and he said, and I got punished for it on the IMDb for doing this creative, thought-provoking type of thing. So what is the ending? First of all, let's just recap the plot here. I mean, the bugs have invaded, and the army has been called, and they shoot all the bugs. And it takes like 20 minutes, and on the commentary, he's like, you know, I'm going to just let you enjoy this, so I'll stop talking until I start talking again. So they shoot everybody, and morning comes. And so then our heroes, the surviving people of the characters we know, emerge out into the big, bright world and find that the city has been evacuated. And there's even a thing that comes up that says, city evacuated at 8:45. Why?
What? Yeah, it's a twist ending, I guess.
And so they're paying the price for what they did, and I guess maybe that's the environmental thing. Is they're paying the price, because the price is once you shoot the bugs, the city was evacuated.
And then there's a shot. I think is the last shot, or just about toward it. It's like the Evil Dead shot where you come in and it implies that something's going to attack him or something, and then it ends.
Yeah, I mean the camera's zooming down the empty streets, and you think that this is a point of view shot from one of the creatures, and it zooms up to the back of Christian Slater's head, and he turns around with this look of horror right as the camera's getting there, and then we cut. And that was the great thought-provoking ending that he got punished for unjustly. The poor guy.
Oh, yeah.
You make a movie, you do a great thing for society, and just Sergeant Guy 76 just rakes you over the coals. It's the end of the show. Time to solve the mystery of the teddy bear that starred in The Hunt for Red October and one other movie earlier. Steven, what do you think it is?
AI, artificial intelligence?
No, I'll give you a hint. The movie that we're talking about here was released in Finland under the title Only Over My Dead Body, as translated back into English. Does that help you at all?
No.
Okay, stronger clue. Hunt for Red October is directed by John McTiernan, and so was this other movie. Does that help?
Die Hard?
Oh, yes, Die Hard. The whole
point
of that.
The giant teddy bear.
Yeah.
The
whole point was for me to ask a question that the answer was Die Hard, and you wouldn't be able to get it. So, yeah. That's funny.
That's it for episode 43, but on the last day of July next week, we'll have another episode for you. And in the meantime, on the website at allmovietalk.com, that's the name of the show, All Movie Talk, with a little .com at the end, we got plenty of other great discussion for you.
Boy, do I love that .com. I also love the .com on the end of Rinkworks, RANKWORKS. Bunch of movie-related things that you can see there. And that'll tide you over to our next episode, episode 44, where I am so excited because we're going to talk about my favorite director in a director's spotlight, Alfred Hitchcock. Don't miss that one. That's a great one. We're also going to have a little nod to Harry Potter. Lots of Harry Potter-related things going on in the past couple weeks. Check that out. And our top six list, a little bit similar to last week, actually. This is going to be the top six great remakes. A remake that is maybe better than the original, but at least a great movie. So check it out, episode 44.
And cut. No, you know, can I try that again? I really don't feel that I had the right kind of vibe to it. Let me try that one again. Let me another take. Here we go. Cut. No, still. No, just one more. Just one more. I promise. One more. Cut. Oh, I totally did something wrong. Come on. I promise. Just one more. I gotta get this right for the close up. Here we go. Cut.